Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. This is another episode of Darshiv. Today, I'm going to be talking a little bit with some of our colleagues at the Archives and Special Collections. During the fall semester of 2019, we held an open house on April 24th, which was called In a Manner of Speaking, which was an evening sort of celebrating discourse in the archives and kind of the narratives that we hold within our collections. So each of the archivists pulled out a handful of things, basically covered the walls, tables, reading room, etc., with some of the cool stuff that we've got. And I've got each archivist on the record basically talking about the things that they've pulled out. So for the next 40 minutes or so, please sit back and listen to the audio candy of the Archives and Special Collections open house.
My name is Rebecca Parmer, and I'm the head of Archives and Special Collections. So the event is called In a Manner of Speaking, and it's an open house that is really designed to give sort of an inside look at the varying ways in which archives speak to us. So the modes of expression, from creative endeavor to personal narrative to organizational accounts, and the ways in which we, as observers, sort of witness this moment in history and struggle with and engage in conversation around and really think about the perspectives and the viewpoints and the narratives that are put forth through these, you know, really staid, lifeless collections. So on their own, these are pieces of paper, these are books, these are artworks, but our task is to really think about what perspective, what viewpoint this offers into that moment in time. We really have opened it up primarily to the research community here at UConn, so faculty, students, staff, as the primary users of this material, but then we've also extended it into the collectors, the donors, the people for whom these collections are meaningful, who have built these collections over time, who are continually engaged with or interested in, as a way of in part showing our thanks and as a way to show them how we use this material, how this material is used by others, and again, you know, the ways in which we sort of engage in this conversation. It's hard to choose because, you know, I think we go into this field with a love of all of this type of material, but I'm really drawn to a couple of things in particular. I have a profound love of scrapbooks, in part because I think it is one of the clearest ways to get a sense of a personal narrative that is not written in a diary or a journal. These are the things that are meaningful to people, that they want to remember, speaks to that those themes of memory, remembrance, of recollection. I think they give us a really interesting snapshot into a particular moment in time, whether they're students and it's the scrapbook of their student years, you know, here at UConn, or whether it's around topics that they're interested in. We have lots of scrapbooks of, you know, people who clip out newspaper clippings around particular topics, and I think that tells us a lot about both that moment in time, but also the creator of those books.
I'm Melissa Batt. I'm an archivist here in Archives and Special Collections. I oversee the literary collections and the rare books collections, such as they are. But I can tell you that the rare books collections now are not the rare books collections of old. They include, as you see here, graphic novels. They include spoken word albums. They include artist books. They include catalogs of artists, contemporary artists that, say, reference materials in the archive. So that's what you see here. It's really terrific. This is Elizabeth Catlett, who is the illustrator. She illustrated Margaret Walker's, who was a Harlem Renaissance era poet, her poem For My People. And she is a lithographer. These are stone lithography, brilliant colors, but also very large format. And We get this book requested a lot, particularly by the fine art grad students who heard about it and are interested in lithography. But it's really exciting, and I put it together with these other art catalogs depicting collage, which is kind of a contemporary art that a lot of African-American artists have brought into their art making, collage, referencing old images, referencing archival materials, and bringing them into their art today.
Yeah, hi, I am Laura Smith. I am I'm one of the archivists in Archives and Special Collections, and the collections I oversee are the Rare Earth History Collections, Connecticut Business and Labor, and some professional organizational records, and some Connecticut History Collections. And I brought some examples out from the collections I oversee. One of them in particular, an item that I really love, is kind of a wide-angle shot of the crew at the Cedar Hill Engine House in New Haven, Connecticut. These are railroad workers for the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad. And it's 40 or 50 men, and they're all posed for the camera at the roundhouse. You can see the engines in the background. And I like it because it shows kind of the common railroad worker in his work spot. And also, you know, I want to say that in all of the railroad photographs that we have, which I can easily count them, you know, well above 200,000 separate images in the entire collection, there are very few photographs of African-American workers. And you know that the railroad must have hired African-American workers, but there's no photos of them. So this photo from the Cedar Hill Engine House in New Haven, Connecticut, does show some African-American workers and provides proof that the railroad did employ black workers. I brought out some diaries that we recently received that were authored by a station agent and telegrapher named John Merritt, and he was at the railroad station in Lenox and Lee, Massachusetts, and he kept a personal diary from 1933 to 1940. And it gives a great snapshot of kind of what was going on regionally and nationally and even internationally. You know, toward the 1940s, you know, he was commenting on the unrest in Europe, the lead up to war. You know, and here's this kind of regular guy who worked at a railroad station in southern Massachusetts who's commenting on international events. I also brought out just some examples from some images from the Railroad History Collections. I like to bring out photos kind of showing men posed next to steam engines. There's a nice nostalgic element to that. Kind of the typical, what you think of is kind of the railroad guy posed against his steam engine. They're I consider them very beautiful items. I also brought out some strike bulletins from a 1946 Pratt & Whitney division strike that was in West Hartford, Connecticut. And it was a very contentious strike. It was a very passionate, everyone was very, all the strikers were very passionate about gaining their rights, gaining what they felt they were worth. And the bulletins really illustrate that. You know, they're passionate and strident. I also brought out some safety tips posters that were used at the Waurigan Quinebaug Textile Company in Eastern Connecticut, and they're a great item because they're fairly pithy. You know, they say defeat the heat, take more salt and water, or wherever you stand, be sure it is strong and secure enough to hold you up. They're very common sense. Factory floor warnings, and you can just see them being on display in a workplace. I think they're from the 1940s to 1950s. Mm-hmm. And the last item I want to show is some writing from a woman named Louise Gaffney Flanagan. She was a poet who was the sister and wife of a railroad worker. In the New Haven, Connecticut area. And there was a lodge, a brotherhood, a fellowship for which she wrote these poems. The thing is, at that time, the 1880s, railroad work was extremely dangerous, especially for these the type of workers that she was writing for. They were brakemen. They were, which was literally, they were traveling on top of the railroad cars. It was extremely dangerous work. So she would write poems to the dead, the dead railroad workers, or you know, ones who were hurt or injured, and they're just a beautiful historic item that I'm proud to show.
I'm Dr. Patrick Butler. I'm the Education and Outreach Coordinator here at the Archives and Special Collections at UConn. This is a 17th century early printed book of Roman law, produced in Frankfurt in 1623. And what's pretty unique about this particular piece is not only its early date of printing, but the fact that its spine is fractured in one place, and we can see a roughly 12th to 13th century medieval manuscript in its spine. It's actually a practice for early bookmaking that medieval manuscripts would be shredded because they were basically filler material for a lot of printing workshops close at hand, usually a lot of it. Something that seems absolutely ridiculous now, but it was very common practice during the day. Especially when you look at the changes that printmaking coming at a time with a shift in the Protestant Reformation, the idea of what was considered Catholic sacred texts and Protestant sacred texts were very fluid. So what was considered disposable was a very open question to printmakers. It does seem kind of sacrilegious almost, but like the fragment that we have in the spine of this particular piece is from the Old Testament book of Jeremiah. But because it was maybe a defective copy, it does have a lot of scribal errors to it. It isn't a very good, clean copy of the text. It might have been just fit for deconstruction and basically used to reinforce the spine of another project. And it's very interesting that this is coming at a time where printers are looking back to the antiquity as opposed to the medieval period for inspiration. This is like a reviving of what is considered enlightened views on law. Coming straight from the Roman period. Scribes in the medieval period were very thrifty because vellum was so expensive. So any time that you could abbreviate the most common phrases in Latin, they did it. And this medieval manuscript fragment is no exception to that. There's a lot there that needs to be expanded upon. So.
I'm Clara Wynn. I'm the project archivist for the Maurice Sendak Collection. And we're really excited tonight to have all these materials out. This collection that I'm from the collection right now, I'm pulling works set from the titles The Miami Giant and Presto and Zesto, which are more recent titles published by Maurice Sendak. They're really kooky stories. They include preliminaries and final drawings, but most interestingly, all of these are made with watercolor and ink, and they're incredibly detailed. They feature a giant who's really clumsy but loves to dance, but he goes to a world of regular-sized humans, and he crushes some of them by accident, more or less, and they run away in fear. So he has to return back to the land from he came from to express himself again. Yeah, so that's in whole what's showing here. Thank you, Graham.
I'm Kristen Eshelman, and I am an archivist at Archives and Special Collections, responsible for the multimedia collections, Northeast Children's Literature Collection, artist books, all kinds of things. Yeah, so it's a wide variety of things, just like my responsibilities. So the first thing is this Playtime Melody Library Mother Goose Rhymes book. This work is mainly Old English children's songs. It provides for you the lyrics to the song, and then also there's the sheet music. So the idea is that you would have played these on the piano and had the kind of, you know, playtime party or playtime melody party, as it's described. So we recorded Sweet Lavender, which is an old English children's song that has been repeated over and over again. And then also the other one is The Old Man All Clothed in Leather, which has also apparently been recorded again and again, and is a quite an old children's song. So this is a nice little compilation, and it was nice that we were able to find various recordings of some of these tunes. The Sweet Lavender tune, we had a number of recordings from Burl Ives to Slim Whitman doing it, a jazz version, so a kind of jazz standard of the song. So lots of people have done it. I guess it's captured people's attention over the years, and so we have those recordings as well. And then there were two other things from the recording library that we pulled. One is Israel Songs for Children in Hebrew. This came out of a collection of children's works that were collected because the person was a reviewer of children's books and recordings. And so this particular recording is from Folkways, and so we had a recording from that that we pulled, and then also another Folkways recording, You Can't Beat Those, Colonial and Revolutionary War Sea Songs and Chanties, sung at Seaport 1976. And from this, we recorded Fare Thee Well, My Dearest Nancy, which is a song that, if you're at all interested in folk music or even country rock from, say, the late 60s and early 70s, you will recognize that song. I think lots of people have done that, particularly English bands. So that's from the recording collection. And then we also, I pulled something from the Magdalena Gomez papers. Magdalena Gomez is a poet who is living in Springfield, Massachusetts. And in the, again, late 60s and early 70s, she was part of the group of Puerto Rican poets in New York who were really trying to create a new language of poetry from a particularly Puerto Rican perspective, but to distinguish from Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico, they were interested in sharing their voice as people who were living in New York City. And so we pulled this newspaper, Everything for Everybody, in which one of her poems is published. It's dated January 1st through the 14th of 1976. So the poem is, of course, one angle into this particular artifact, but the other angle is the newspaper itself, and I really didn't know anything about it. And I discovered that Everything for Everybody is actually an organization that was started to provide storefronts, if you will, or actual locations that you could go to in New York City with any problem you had. You have something you want to buy, you have something you want to sell, you need a job, you have jobs that you want to give away, you have clothes that you want to share, you have food, you need food, anything at all, this organization was going to provide for you in some way, either connect you with people or make it possible for you to obtain the thing that you were looking for. And so just even looking at this one newspaper and kind of digging a little deeper to find out what was going on with this organization, it has been a pretty interesting thing for me. And I think it's pretty illustrative of what happens when you come to the archive. And, you know, you can really approach these collections both contextually, which is how they're organized, but you can also look at individual artifacts and kind of go off on a tangent and find that there's a whole history behind those as well that, you know, that may provide you with some other idea, other historical artifacts. A new acquisition we had this year is an addition to the Samuel Charters papers, the Archive of Blues and African-American Vernacular Music. And what we got were a lot of the field notes and correspondence from many of his different projects. But what I pulled out for the open house was some of the field notes and correspondence with the actual performers on the Folkways recording African Journey, A Search for the Roots of the Blues. And it's pretty interesting stuff. It's his maps. He, so when he was in West Africa and South Africa. He, you know, he had his maps and his diaries, and then there's a letter between Sam Charters and Moses Ash, dated 1975, in which he discusses what he has actually recorded in the field and the translations that he has for the songs. There's a contract between Sam and one of the performers that's dated 1974, a very brief contract. This is pretty typical of what Sam's contracts look like when he was out in the field and he would record a piece of music. He would write on a piece of paper, and frankly, it could be any piece of paper. It could be a scrap of paper. The date, and then I, and in this case, it's Jali Suso is the performer, received of Sam Charters the sum of D period 20, so I don't know what the denomination is, but for recording assistance, and then there's an X, and then Mr. Suso is actually signing. So that's the extent of the contract. And then there's some field notes, and in the case of Mr. Charters, he really was kind of whenever he had an idea, whether it was concerning the recording itself or just his observations of the place that he was in, because a lot of the things that he's done with his liner notes and even his writings, you might say they're more creative writing or just narratives that both give you a context in terms of place. So describing the place he's in, describing the smells, the sights, the sounds, but then also writing very specifically about the recordings themselves and the music. So there's a lot of that kind of field note taking. And then there's a letter from another performer written after Mr. Charters returns from the trip, and he's at that time living in Stockholm, Sweden. And the letter is from a performer who's saying, I got your letter and I was very happy to learn that you got home safely, and I did the job of translations. The six songs are all done, and he's sending them in the package. So in this case, Sam, because he didn't have the language skills, had to ask for the songs to be translated, and particularly because he knew that the stories that were being told in the songs were very important for the context of the music. So we got a collection just at the end of last year. It's the Alice and Douglas Highland collection of children's literature. And it so happens that a number of the works in the collection were really books, illustrated books, that may at first appearance seem like children's books, but really they're adult-themed illustrated works. So there's a work by Ronald Searle, The Situation is Hopeless. Many of the listeners probably know who Roz Chast is, so Roz Chast, The Party After You Left. And then Edward Gorey's Amphigory, which is a collection of 15 books that Edward Gorey wrote and published, but that were pretty limited editions, so they left the market very quickly. And so this is like a compilation of the works. It was published in 1972, but I was particularly interested in the work of pornography that's in the book itself. I think it's called the Curious Sofa. So that's what I pulled out in particular from the Edward Gorey work. The Roz Chast, if you know her work, it's not so much that there are books, but it's kind of like cartoons, and but all very, you know, there's political themes and there's all kinds of things. So the one I particularly liked was you see a field and there's a gravestone, and it reads, tuned in, turned on, dropped out, dropped in, worked out, saved up, dropped dead. So I thought that was right on. And then the Ronald Searle is quite good. It's the marketing for the book reads, every race and every country has its own increasingly bizarre hang-ups. Animals too, as Ronald Searle now reveals. They have universal ones, And however resigned we may be about our own peculiarities, it's comforting to know that there are equally imbecilic inhabitants of the animal kingdom. And I was particularly interested in the bald eagle illustration. It reads, American bald eagle suddenly realizing that its leanings are basically Marxist. So that was a nice addition, I thought, to the collection. Because as many of your listeners know, we have a big children's literature collection, the Northeast Children's Literature Collection, but there are often these things that creep in as well that are really adult-themed. And frankly, much of the children's work is, I think, equally good for adults. So.
And speaking of music, what is it that we've been listening to in the background?
Yeah, so this is a small collection of works that also comes out of the Samuel Charters archive. And it is works in the genre that's called Tropicalia. And this is a kind of, as it's been described, ill-defined movement in Brazil, particularly solidifying what few ideas there were around this movement in the music. The idea was that there were musicians who were and other artists who were interested in not necessarily being influenced by the outside, having a more not so much traditional, but what would you say is a Brazilian sound or a Brazilian point of view. And then, but also recognizing that there were lots and lots of influences on the culture from outside. And so how do you absorb those without kind of becoming something else? So that's really what the movement was about. There were different aspects in the art world that were, you know, trying to translate these ideas into the work. But this recording is actually... So that movement was like late 60s, early 70s, into the 70s, even a little bit into the 80s. But this particular recording is Brazil Classics, and it was issued by David Byrne, who your listeners will know from the Talking Heads, in 1989 as a compilation of these recordings that he was discovering at the time. So he didn't know anything about the movement, didn't know anything about the genre. Came upon it in the late 80s and decided he would collect some of the classic songs and issue it. So there's two volumes, and it's just called Brazil Classics. It's and it's David Byrne does the gathering, the collecting. So that's what we listen to.
This is Graham Stinnett, the archivist for the Alternative Press and Human Rights Collections. For the open house, I have pulled a few things, various different kinds of mediums, a blacklight poster from our porous collection of Vietnam War memorabilia, and I've got a blacklight affixed to it so that you can actually see the paint quality that they've made these posters out of. I have a light table set up with some slides, slide film from a 1975 Gay Pride parade in New York City, which the local Hartford chapter Gay Liberation Group was involved in. Also some slides from the Eric Miller photography series of the Impact Visuals collection, where he was documenting the end of apartheid in South Africa. A t-shirt, Black Flag, hardcore punk band from California. That's from the Joe Snow Punk Rock Collection. And then also a series of photographs from the University of Connecticut Photography Collection, Black Student Sit-In Protest in 1974, and then some associated materials from the coalition that was formed as a sort of broad umbrella of progressive student groups on campus at that time. They published a newspaper, only a couple of issues, called Forward Motion, that really lays out sort of the demands of the student body at that time. And then from the Steve Thornton Collection, the manual on When Hate Groups Come to Town, a handbook of model community responses, a grassroots way to kind of educate folks about when groups like the Klan or neo-Nazis come to your town or your university and how to kind of respond to it by teaching around that. and some of the corresponding material from that collection as well about what was called Unity Day in 1982, when the Klan was booking a series of events where they were rallying. And then a very large contingency of folks from unions and auto workers and NAACP and socialist and anarchist groups, LGBT groups, churches getting together to oppose the Klan and go out and march against them. And then connected to that is some of the white supremacy material from UConn's campus in the last few years that we've seen arise, and bringing those things into the collection. And finally, some God Bless Graffiti posters. That is from a folio of a collective of street artists who have done a lot of late 90s, early 2000s artwork around things like the Bush era, drug usage, legalization of spray painting, private property destruction, those kinds of commentaries that they riff on a lot with spray, sticker, stencil, poster, wheat paste, a lot of different kinds of mediums being used to basically make the walls more colorful in urban spaces. And that's pretty much it. Thanks.
We are open Monday through Friday at 9 to 4. Please come back anytime. Make use of the material. It's there for you as the community, as the public, and we hope to see you soon.
You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the UConn Archives and Special Collections at UConn Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at whus.org. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melica Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.